So this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Flight Lieutenant Lou Dudridge, recorded on March the 14th at Lou's house in Goldstream in Langford. It is interviewed by Ben Fast, a student at the University of Victoria. Now, Flight Lieutenant Dudridge, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes.
Thank you very much. So let's just make sure that this is all on and ready to go. So, first of all, can I get you to spell your last name for me, please?
D-U-D-D-R-I-D-G-E, Dudridge.
Dudridge, perfectly. And where were you born?
Hanley, H-A-N-L-E-Y, Saskatchewan.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the town was like when you were young?
Considering it was the dirty 30s when I was young, terrible conditions. It was a good little town. Lots of sports, sports days, aggressive little town. In a book that I wrote, I listed all the boys that were killed there and what part of that community they were born in, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. So it's very high in my memory list. My brother and I both had feelings at times that we'd never see Hanley again. The way the guys, especially my brother, he was on a fighter squadron, and he wouldn't even get serious with a girl, and I had not worried about that and got serious and got engaged, in fact got married. So mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's about all I can say about Hanley. It was a million bushel grain point, a great farming area, except that it didn't rain for many years, from about 1930 on for 7 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And when were you born? When were you born?
I was born in 1918. Yeah.
What was the date?
March the 7th, 1918.
We are joined on the interview by the puppy as well, it seems.
Yeah, right.
So what was your interest?
No.
Hey, you gonna talk?
Yeah.
What was your interest in the military as a young man?
I don't know, Raggy. My interest as...
All right. Well, we'll just carry on.
She'll get out.
Yeah.
Once she gets
bored.
Bored.
New friends.
Yeah.
Hey.
Hey.
Oh well. There you go. Good. So the question was, what was your interest in the military as a young man?
Yeah. You know, that my most distinct recollection is watching aircraft go over. They followed the railroad track and the highway between Regina and Saskatoon, and there'd be the odd one following that track and that road, and I was felt. My blood pressure go up a tiny bit, and don't forget, you didn't see a lot of them. Weeks could go by, and then all of a sudden you'd see three or four single engine aircraft moving. And so that created an interest definitely in my mind, and it definitely had an influence. It affected me to the point of wanting to ask them and to tell them that I'd like to be a pilot. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. And was any of your other family before you and your brother in the military?
No, definitely not.
Just yourself?
Yeah. My brother was younger than myself, and so he was a year and a half later getting in than I was. So I joined him June the 7th, 1940. And he was about a year and a half after that.
Okay. But nobody...
I wish you could have interviewed him, but him, unfortunately, he died young.
Yeah.
Not in the Air Force. He died of a heart attack.
That's bad. But no father or uncles in the military or anything like that? No.
None.
So what was your life like before you enlisted? What were you doing day to day?
Looking for work. Riding the rails. And that's an actual fact. If you want to hear of a lucky little story, my mom put every penny together that she could, and Dad, it was $7, and she made a nice lunch, and a guy named Doug Hudson and I went out, and we got on a freight train and got kicked off at Brandon by the military, by the railway police, and slept in the ditch that night and walked into Brandon the next morning alone because I lost my chum. He was kicked off on the opposite side of the train as I was. Anyhow, there was a huge soup lineup. It was a desperate year. There was no crop, except there was some crop at Brandon. I went across the street, and a car stopped and said, "Are you looking for work, young fellow?" And I was flabbergasted. I just said, "Yes." I didn't ask anything about salary or hours or anything else. I just... And it turned out to be a wonderful piece of luck. And went to a house that had sewer and water on the farm and all this, if you can imagine, in 1940. Then went to a lumber camp in the winter with one of the sons. And ended up getting a job. As a result of that, and ended up getting that ring. As a result of that, this guy took a liking to me, working in a kitchen, and so just there was a series of fortunate things, good things that happened. But then I was about as dumb a farm boy as you can humanly possibly imagine. Just no experience with cities. Got a job at 424 the main drag of Winnipeg. Anyhow, it doesn't matter. And I did well at that job, working for a Singer sewing machine company, and was able to buy a car and go home in relative style in the next spring because I didn't have to ride the rails.
And that was all before you enlisted?
That was all before I enlisted, yeah.
Okay.
And so then... I did odd jobs, plus helping my dad on the farm. My dad bought a farm in 1930 on a crop share basis. Never had grew one kernel of grain. And so he lost the farm, he lost his machinery, and so that's when he came up to me and said, "Lou, you're just going to have to find work. You're just going to have to go someplace and find work. And so that's how come I got on the, didn't have money to buy a ticket, so we jumped the rail and went. I told you what happened. I can't remember exactly how that connected to going into the recruiting place in Saskatoon. But the two chaps that I went into the recruiting station with, Ray Hunter and Woody Trask, both became navigators in the Air Force. They both died on a mission, as did 11 or 12 others from this little town. At that particular, I think I was very lucky in my interview in Saskatoon, because I must have exposed a fairly decent IQ, because I didn't have my grade 12, and as you most likely have found out already, you couldn't get into aircrew in 1940 if you didn't have your grade 12. But they organized an evening courses on that would give me an equivalency to grade 12, which I passed. And so that's how come I got into aircrew, despite the fact I didn't have my grade 12.
So those courses were after you had enlisted, they upgraded you?
After I had actually in the Air Force, I took night classes, and I don't think it was really well organized. I think you got the papers and read them and answered the questions, and I think I must have done quite well, and because next thing I know, the Air Force in 1940, I don't suppose, was terribly well organized. After all, they hadn't been in a war before. You only had 2,000 people in the Air Force in 1940, and it ended up with over 200,000 people in the Air Force. A little bit of disorganization somewhere or other, because they sent me on a mechanics course to St. Thomas, Ontario, a 6-month course, which I passed and became an LAC mechanic, and was posted to number 4 SFTS in Saskatoon, working on Cessna cranes as a mechanic, and then my transfer to aircrew came through. and there was a ITS right in Saskatoon, and so I went directly down and got in training for aircrew.
So did you do the full 6-month course before?
Yes. Yes.
What did your parents or your family think of you enlisting?
They were both British, and they both knew something had to be done. When you think in that little town that 15 young men did not come back, and they were all in the aircrew. It was a pretty big kick in the pants. And regarding my own parents, my mom did not come to the station to say goodbye. She was, my dad took me to the station when I was leaving for the Air Force, and he was a very, very sentimental man, and one little interesting thing to me, very interesting, I had a little black book that I kept little notes in, and he wanted to tell me, he would, because he was British, born over there, he had relatives over there which he wanted us to visit, wanted me to visit, and he didn't tell me because he would have broken down. So he took that little black book and he wrote in there, go to Krakow and ask if anybody remembers Charlie. And change that word Krakow, because that's my mother's that's my mother's hometown, my dad. Bridgewater. And so my brother and I did go to Bridgewater a couple of years later, because he got in and went immediately into air crew, because he didn't have to, no 6-month course that was irrelevant. And we went there and did find somebody that remembered Charlie. So I rode home and took him, and I imagine Len, my brother, did. But being in the, and this, so I go down in Saskatoon to ITS, and when I get there, my brother is there. He's on the same course. He's been accepted, and so there's two Dudridges, and we both passed at ITS in Saskatoon. We both passed at initial training school at Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. And then we were both transferred to Dauphin, Manitoba, and we both passed there, got our wings. And you would have found it, he was an excellent student, always first in his class, and I was a mediocre student, and so he was also a fantastic athlete, fantastic baseball pitcher, and so he just traveled in a different circle, because I was not really athletic in later years. I thought I did the kind of things that you would most likely like, curling and stuff like that, and I wasn't pretty good at it. Should I tell you a tiny bit about my brother and his relationship, Ben, as he was also a pilot?
Sure.
It was common knowledge that every chap that got to be his pilot's wings wanted to fly Spitfires. And he got to fly Spitfires, and it was a kind of a strange thing. He was in an accident and lost all of his thumb and all of his, most of this finger and part of this one. And so we get to Banff in Scotland to fly, I'll come back to the name of the aircraft. And this aircraft had something, the Piper Pacer. Oh, no, that's not right. It'll come to me. And so we get to a station, an AFU, Advanced Flying Unit, at Banff in Scotland, and they're flying this aircraft. Just leave a little space and I'll definitely come up to it. I'm doing okay with this aircraft, and Len is not getting anywhere because he can't taxi it. Now that aircraft had on the control column, there was a button you had to press and when you wanted to turn port or starboard on the ground to taxiing, you had to, when you pressed the brake, you had to press that button with the thumb of your left hand. He had no thumb on his left hand. Mm-hmm. So they moved him to Rhyl in Scotland and to fly Miles Masters. Now I could think of that one. It was the aircraft that pilots got their experience to put them in the seat of a Spitfire. And I went to visit him there, and he was doing fine. I knew he was going to make the grade. I forget where he went on, but after he graduated, and he told me about what the first flight in his Spitfire was like, and there's no aircraft like it, and with it's got dual seats, and so you just have to learn everything in the Miles Master, and this one day they put you in the Spitfire, and away you go, and that was an interesting little story. But anyhow, he made the grade, and he flew in Great Britain for maybe 6 months, and then his transfer to North Africa and Malta came through, and that's where he did two tours. And he was an absolute excellent pilot, but the reason I found out quite a bit about it was we met twice in London. Being as he did two tours, he was there for quite a while, and I would find out when he'd let me know when he was getting some leave, and I'd meet him in London, and so I got to know quite a bit about what it was like. And he told me quite bluntly that he hated the thought of getting a second tour. But they asked him to do a second tour, and I don't know how much pressure there was, but anyhow he had to do the second tour. And then when he finished that, they were doing, they've transferred him from the Royal Air Force to the Royal Canadian Air Force. I forget the squadron number, but anyhow, they did a landing in southern France, and it was a very much a success. And so that basically was his. It would be nice for him to be. He had a pretty good ability to tell stories, and I think you'd have enjoyed sitting with him, because he was actually shot down once before he went to a Focke-Wulf 190 shot him down, and he managed to land the thing. It was his prop propeller was shot off, and he was on fire. And he landed in a fairly large field, the second he touched down and could get out of the cockpit, he started to run, and it exploded and just knocked him down, didn't hurt him at all. And so he got out of that mess, that was the closest he came to anything terribly bad. Having never flown a fighter or never been on a fighter squadron, it made me realize it was not a piece of cake. You know, if I got into trouble, I had six people with me. When he got into trouble, he had nobody with him. He had to sort it out for himself. Sometimes that kind of gives me the shivers just to think of I know I use my crew quite a bit, she left us alone for a little bit. So anyhow, I just wanted to touch on him because he was very close to me, and there were not too many brother situations. When we got our wings, my mom came from Hanley, Saskatchewan, and pinned the wings on the first mother in Canada to pin the wings on two sons at a wings parade. I think of that quite often. And when we got to Halifax to leave and were called out to put on such and such a ship, it was the Ile de France. Now I can think of that too. That was the ship we went over on, the Ile de France, and ISLE, DE, France. And so we're just barely on the boat, and somebody in authority came up with two armbands, and we're each given an armband, and that armband gave us access to any place on the boat during that trip. And that we were designated as go-between the military and the crew of that boat. And it made it, just made the trip. I can't imagine a luckier thing to happen, because time went faster. We did lose one boat out of our convoy, taken down by the submarines. Because we could get around, and when this was going on, we didn't have to stay in our quarters. We could do whatever we needed to do to be go-betweens between the military and the crew of that boat. I have to confess, mind you, I had one. I told you about the little breaks I've had in life, but the biggest break, of course, I had was I was allowed to live. I was not shot down. It seemed to me that when the going got tough, I'd get a transfer to another position. For instance, I was on coastal patrol in a Lancaster, and there's no comparison on that job when you start comparing it with a trip over Germany. There's just no comparison. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I don't think you'll talk to much luckier a pilot than this guy right here.
Well, I want to bring it back to your enlistment. Why did you sign up?
I desperately wanted to fly.
Yeah.
And I figured that even though I had this disadvantage, that there'd be a way around it, and there was a way around it, and I passed that exam, and so I got into air crew. And it was by the luck of the draw, my brother and I graduated together in 1942.
Did you think when you were going in that you might not be a pilot, but maybe another role on the plane?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Because we were hearing all the stories. There was nothing to tell me I was going to be a pilot. I mean, after all, if I was so dumb as to think that they had to make a pilot out of me, it would have made me start thinking when they started crewing up, when we started getting our crews together. You know, I had to find two young men that were gunners, and I had to find a navigator, and I had to find a bomb aimer, and I had to find an engineer. Those positions all had to be filled. And I knew I was lucky. And I really can't answer why. Maybe start me off again.
Sure. Well, I'll ask you a little bit about the training you received.
Oh, yeah.
So what was the first training that you did after enlisting?
Okay. The first training is Initial Training School, ITS. Mm-hmm. And at that, you study all of the subjects, meteorology, navigation, aircraft identification, what have I missed?
Is it classroom studying?
Classroom studying, yeah. Definitely. No flying whatsoever.
Yeah.
When
did you first fly?
When did I first... Okay. The first course was close to 6 months at ITS in Saskatoon. The next one was at Prince Albert, and I think we flew 65 to 70 hours there in a Tiger Moth on skis. Because it was winter time. And the length of the course, 60 some hours, I'm quite sure. Tiger Moths on skis, and maybe you've never flown on skis, so there's no brakes. Which makes it, one little accident, one scraping His Majesty's aircraft, that's a black mark. And so the bloody business of having those skis were no brakes of any description. You had to learn some pretty tricky stuff to... In fact, I think if you ever had time to read that book, I make a statement in there that on my if you can imagine yourself, you're on about your eighth hour of instruction. You've never flown before, and you're on skis, and you're just taxiing in, and the instructor says, stop here. And you can tell that this guy's going to tell you you're going to go solo now. And so he lets you out in a kind of a respectable place where you can't get into too much trouble taxiing on skis. And he tells you how long to be up, and then he walks away from you. And it's entirely different than going to take a lesson now at the Victoria Flying Club. There's no comparison whatsoever. They keep a terrible pressure on you. What is that pressure? That pressure is called washout. You know that some of your chums have been washed out, and rumors keep flying around, and so anyhow you're on this trip. This first, he tells you to go solo. And so you gotta get the skis loose from this fresh snow, and taxi back to the takeoff point. And that next part is not too tough, because you put power on and you go down the runway on the ice and you take off. The next part is the approach is a tough one on skis, because you know damn well that if you make any kind of a mistake and you run off the end of the field and nose over something, that you're out of the course. And so I guess I'll just never forget it. There was a lot of pressure there. And I did not too badly. And so my time is up, and I made damn sure I didn't go anywhere near that building where my instructor was waiting for me, so that I just stayed a respectable distance away and turned the switch off and got the hell out of there. And he's been watching you, and then he gives you some instructions, and the lessons are all, I'm going to go and get something and show you that I made when I was an instructor afterwards. Just
sure.
You give
sure.
you a better idea
yeah.
of what the hell I'm talking about. I had my wife type out all my lesson plans.
Oh, yeah.
And all the instructions and lessons 1 to 20 something. And I took it every Tuesday. We meet a bunch of old guys that were in the Air Force. And I took it and showed it to them. And I put it some damn place. And it's just. three or 4 or 5 days ago, I was 96, and with that age bit came memory problems, and just as you're, when it comes time for you to leave, I'll run up there once more and hope that, because I want you to see it, it just is... something I made myself as when I was an instructor in 51. I started flying again in 50, and flying in Calgary and instructing in Calgary, and guys from all over the world. The Royal Royal Canadian Air Force volunteered to train these guys. The Korean War was hot and heavy, etc. And so I took all these lesson plans, and my wife did the typing, and it was, I just bloody well wanted to show you. It was quite thick.
Yeah.
So anyhow, that's lesson number one. And then the two might be going solo. And then the pictures in there of when you get to the point of doing spin recovery and all of this kind of business. Anyhow, I was kind of proud of it, and it was only one in the course, because I'd made the damn thing, and anyhow, mm-hmm. Go back to where we were.
Sure. So what was the, would you explain where your training occurred? You mentioned Prince Albert, and then where did you go after that?
Prince went to, if you passed there, if you passed as a pilot there, you went to Dauphin, Manitoba to fly Cessna cranes. Have you seen a crane? You know what they're like. They have all of the everything that you're going to run into in the future. For instance, flaps, pitch control, prop pitch. It's all there, and so they can teach you. They can teach you the effect of changing pitch on the prop. They can teach you the effect of an undercarriage coming down, and the drag that it creates. And they can teach you, because it's a twin, they can teach you the effect of loss of power on one side. It was, you would not believe the effect that the British Commonwealth Air Training Scheme had on Canada. You know, when you think there's 100 airports built, and they had to find all of this stuff, and we had student pilots coming from Rhodesia, Australia, New Zealand. We had them coming from Great Britain, because they couldn't train enough over there. All done in your little Canada. And it, there was no doubt that it was very precise. It was very tough on students, because there was no pity given. They just hung that washout thing in front of you, and you knew bloody well that if you were a smart ass, if you flew low and caught some crap in the undercarriage because you're doing something stupid, your chances of continuing in the course were not very great, because they did mind having a daredevil, but they didn't want a horse's ass, you know, and they couldn't have a horse's ass, because the guy might become the pilot of a Lancaster with a crew that would like to keep living if humanly possible. And so the pressure was absolutely unbelievable. Now, how did my brother compare to me? I I'd say that in the desk work at ITS, he would be a little ahead of me because he was a better student. But when it came to the flying, I think we were fairly even. I realized afterwards that after that we had graduated, that the dangers of Lennon, my brother, and I being washed out were pretty slim because we were doing fine. We didn't get caught doing something stupid. We didn't mark up an aircraft. That's pretty important. It's taxiing accidents, you know, brushing the wing tip against another aircraft or against anything, hangar, door. So that's what they were looking for. They were looking for good, steady people. But, of course, my brother was, for part of his in North Africa, he was on the same squadron as that famous Canadian pilot fight.
Burling? It was.
He didn't like discipline. That was his downfall. But he didn't have a downfall. He could get away with it because he had some bloody ability to correlate things in his eyes. When he was coming up onto a German fighter, he could sort out that deflection shooting, all the rest of it. But along with that came Buzz Burling's hatred of discipline, but it cost him promotion, of course. But that's about all it cost him.
You mentioned that you and your brother didn't mark up any airplanes, but how frequent were accidents and crashes in training?
When you get way down the road to operational training unit, death was frequent, aircraft destruction was frequent. Why was it frequent? Because you had to come as close to reality in your training as was humanly possible. And if you could look at the life of an operational training unit in Great Britain, I don't think they ever disclosed the exact number of our guys that died. If you were to turn way down to the section where it tells about the ones from Hanley that died, you'd find that right in there was two or three at 02 operational training units are killed.
How did that affect you as you were going through training?
It doesn't. No. It's a strange thing. It doesn't affect you. It better not affect you. And it didn't affect me. There's something about youth that covers that. Yes, there is. There's something about being young. If you taxi to Lancaster, up out on a piece of runway right out there, and said, "Would you like to get in that and fly? Take it off and fly it?" I wouldn't be able to do it, despite the fact that I flew for 68 years of my life. I quit flying about 8 years ago. But it, it, uh, And I flew helicopters for years also. I was crop dusting on the prairies, which in itself is quite a hairy job. You know, you're flying about 8 feet above the ground. So why am I telling you this? Well, because you've asked me a question about how come it didn't affect you when you witness or are part of so many deaths at OTU. It's slowly being disclosed about that fact. How can you compete with a German ace if you haven't got the capabilities of that guy? And how are you going to get the capabilities if you don't extend yourself, if you don't? One stupid death that I can think of, a friend of mine, this was in a fighter squadron. They were doing echelon left. In other words, they had a leader and then another three or four aircraft on the left-hand side. And the leader came to a hill, and he didn't allow enough room for that guy out on the end because he had to follow, and that chap crashed and was killed. And his sister was a good friend of my wife and I. And I wrote her a letter when after the war, when she was questioning why was Chet killed. And I said, well, just the same words as I said to you. How are you going to compete with an enemy if you don't get down to his level of training? But the closer you are to difficult maneuvers, the closer you are to death. That makes sense. And especially you have to remember that you're not fully trained yet. You've got lots of things to learn. Imagine my brother, the day that he was shot down. He hadn't been on the squadron very long. He just was not capable of avoiding that Focke-Wulf 190. An experienced pilot, and Len admitted it to me that I've got a lot of learning to do. And so that's what you just a good pilot was one that was full of good common sense but nervy, you know, having been game to go to the limit, so that. I think Canadians filled in there very, very well because they, I'll tell you a true experience, and this, I don't know what, you can make what you want of it. I was at a station in North England, and I was a station commander. I was a flight commander, and the boss came to me, the CEO came to me and said, I got something that you're not going to enjoy doing, but it's got to be done. There's a man that's got his wings, and we've got to check him out thoroughly because he's doing some terribly stupid things, and I don't think we'd ever get a crew to fly with him. And so I took him up, and low flying was his problem. And so I took him told him the path I wanted him to fly. I had to grab the control because he was going to hit that hill ahead, because he was, everything he was doing was, showed there was something lacking in that man. And so, I think I took him for three rides, and then I wrote a letter and said that we should not ever put this man in charge of a crew because he's going to kill them. And that's, so, you know, the things that can happen and do happen in a war are vastly different from what you have out here at the flying club. dollars and cents are involved in today, and dollars and cents weren't really, if I wrecked an airplane, it was because very likely I did something stupid.
Was there anything from your life before the war that helped you in your training and in your preparation?
Yes, I would say my dad was a help. He was a good common sense person. When I was 12 years old, I was driving six horses, pulling a plow, pulling a disc, pulling a cultivator. He'd get them ready. What does that tell you? It tells you me, once he had me trained, he was not afraid to let me go and do what had to be done. And so, that's what instructors had to be during that war. You just have to remember that there were hundreds and hundreds of instructors instructing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students, and there had to be some good common sense in there. And so, getting back to myself, I would say that my father and his common sense approach to everything he did helped me, because that's what you needed. And there's something must be right, because I rode a motorcycle for 60 some years and never had an accident. I flew over 10,000 hours and never had an accident. I flew, I drove a car since I was 16, and I never had an accident. That can't all be in here. It's got to be instruction and help from somebody. And I have to give my dad the credit.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Never had an accident.
I've never had an accident.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, and you know, my brother died at 70, and he, other than that, you can't call that pothole thing of an accident. No. That was, he was outdone. He was just, he couldn't handle that pilot. He didn't have the experience. You asked a question, and that's my answer. I think it was influence in my life as a young person, my mom and dad.
Yeah. So when you were in training, what did you picture yourself doing once you were involved fully, once you were fully trained?
Well, I tell you. What's the name of that German ace in the First World War?
The Red Baron one? Manfred von Richthofen?
Yeah. When I was a student, and you get up in those cumulus clouds, I would pretend that the Red Baron was in there, and that I was going to get him when he come out, and I'd dive into these clouds and Yeah, it sounds silly, but it's a fact.
So did you think that you wanted to be a fighter pilot?
Oh, there's no question. Yeah, no question. But I knew the decision. I knew that you had little or no chance of doing except the way the cards unfolded, the way they were stacked, and there might be the very odd man that was picked to be a fighter pilot, but by and large, it's just letting the cards fall where they may.
So how did reality compare to training? Was it what you imagined?
I would say I don't think I imagined even remotely closely to reality. Definitely, because I didn't know enough about. I just didn't know enough about what lay ahead to be able to make sensible plans or decisions or whatever you want to call them. I know where you're heading, but where you'd like to, but I just at the moment I can't get some words together that would explain.
Sure, we can come back to it as well, but that was a good answer for me. So
yeah.
So the next few questions are a little bit more about sort of your life during training, not necessarily what you did. So, for example, can you tell me what living conditions were like when you were training?
You see, if it had been you in your home going into 1940, you could see a story coming out, but you have to remember that my brother and I lived under pretty sad conditions. We didn't have spending money. We discipline at home was very strict, of British parentage, exceedingly strict. There is no comparison. Hilda and I have raised four kids, and the discipline, the conditions, just absolutely. So what was happening? When we joined the Air Force, we were going up. We were going up. The conditions, the food was plentiful, generally good. Discipline had not changed a great deal because our parents, we weren't allowed to go into town any night and just goof around. If you were to have the war start right today, you'd have a different attitude among your students because they have been free and easy spending money, dating, just anything you want to. All of a sudden you're into the military and you very likely get a weekend off pretty quick. No, just the general rules that they had planted in your head, and that was the what drunkenness would do, what the what not saluting an officer could cost you, all those kinds of things. It was there's no comparison, I don't think. I don't really think. I think the reader of what I would write or say would wonder, where the hell did this guy come from? How can he be so antiquated in his thinking? But it was a fact. It was an absolute fact. You go to school, the principal of the school was no holds barred. You know, I suppose I was strapped 7 or 8 times in those years in high school. That kind of stuff is gone. And so you, it was easier to go into military in 1940 than it would be in 2000. No question. Unless the young man or woman, were quite prepared to accept whatever the hell happened, it's going to be tough, because all of a sudden you've gone from one level to another level. Back then, food-wise, it was better. Discipline-wise, it was not difficult because you were used to discipline. I honestly feel that's the way it was for me and most of my chums. In other words, but you know, let's face it, the human being is so adaptable, so adaptable. We see the 14, 15-year-old girls now having sex and all the rest of it, but you can't even, that's not even fair to think of that and try to compare it with 1940, because everything is different. The girls have got protection against becoming pregnant. Never dreamt of such a thing in 1940. So it is so damn different that, but then once again I have to come back to the adaptability of a human body and how you see a young man going into the Air Force today, he's maybe had a chum with a fast car, everything. He's had a chance to to adapt to the way it is, and those in 1940 there was no way of running into conditions that would put you in the cockpit of an aircraft. but it didn't seem to matter, except, of course, the Germans and the Russians and the Australians and Canadians all had a parallel opportunity or lack of opportunity, whichever you want to, way you want to look at it. The human being is a wonderful thing. That's what it boils down to, you know. If the human being, if you want to conquer the world, you personally, you can damn near do it in this year. And I've seen it all happen. Right now I'm at Manning Depot, and that was in Brandon, Manitoba. Thousands and thousands of young Canadians are there, and they're learning about discipline. They're learning about how to march. They're learning, and the people that lived on those streets in Brandon in 1940 and 41 and 42 and 43 must have wondered, what's going on here, you know, and what was it about? If some of those were going to be pilots, discipline was uppermost in 1940 in Brandon, Manitoba. You could have a corporal there that had more damn power. You know, he could put you in bloody jail, you know, if you were a horse's ass. And it happened. Nowadays, don't be silly. You know, it's got to be up there somewhere, that kind of authority coming. When somebody's reading 10 years from now about things that you've written, because they have been subjected to this kind of a conversation, they can handle it and understand it, and I'm positive they can. And I'm not a 95-year-old, 96-year-old guy that's down on society and thinks that we're in a hell of a mess, because I don't think we are. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's going to be another world war. And why? Because of a thing called common sense and fear of atom bombs and I think that when you imagine, I was at a conference not too long ago about unmanned aircraft. That's absolutely unbelievable. It begins, you know, you start to wondering, is the human being going to be necessary in this next war? The unmanned thing taking an atom bomb to some bloody place, it's done. It could do it right today. And so where does that leave you and I talking about training to become a pilot? There won't need to be too many pilots. They'll have to be smart people with computers and stuff that can get an aircraft off the ground. And it's happening. I think I mentioned it a minute ago that I was invited to a convention, a 4-day thing, and did nothing but talk about unmanned vehicles, and it's mind-shattering. It's but still, what you're doing, people love stories, and they love to get a chance to look back and see where did we come from. And I'm very, very, very... Why did I write five books? I wrote five books because... I want people to know about the mistakes we make, about the price you pay when you make a mistake. I wrote one novel that, but if you ever decide to write a book, you have to pick a subject that you know something about, or you can't do it. I wrote a novel titled The Murder Came Later, and it went pretty good, but it's military. It was semi-military because that's the only thing I know anything about. I could write a book about farming, but who in the hell wants to? It wouldn't get read. Mm-hmm. My story started off military, and then basically what it was, and just this is just an aside. These young guys are coming home from the war, and they come to a little place in Saskatchewan where there's a group of Nazis living there, and there are some in Saskatchewan, incidentally, Germans, some wonderful Germans too, but some guys still think that Hitler did the right thing. So anyhow, there's this group, and they get more aggressive as the years go by. And so finally they rape and execute a girl who's working for the Women's Auxiliary of the Air Force. And that's how I get it going. And the murder is in a helicopter, which is something I can write about because I flew with them for a few years. That writing was for fun, but my other books were talking about the war and the things that can happen. Mm-hmm. And that's why they've got you young chaps writing up these histories.
Mm-hmm. Helps for understanding. That's what one of the reasons we're doing it is, to help for understanding of what happened, right?
That's right, yeah.
Well, let me ask you another question.
Yep.
What did you do when you were not in training, like on the weekends or the evenings?
In the Air Force, but not in training.
Yeah, for example, what did you do at the end of the day or on the weekend or on leave?
Yeah. A sport was a big thing. A very big thing.
What type of sports?
Baseball, hockey, soccer. Yes, they were all played, and the military supplied sporting goods for you to, so you could play sports. In Great Britain, it was vastly different. It was you had to learn cricket, and so to answer your question, in spare time, it was sports. Church was not a big factor, a very small factor. The hobbies, during that war, everything happened so damn fast. It was difficult for the authorities to handle it all and to have something available to give. But I don't ever remember boredom being a factor. That's interesting, but I do not ever remember being bored. But of course, I'm speaking from my voice is speaking from the aviation side of the military. I think it would be vastly different from the from if you were in a sleeping area with airmen. That would be the conversation. And women, of course, it would be a conversation.
Did you have interaction with people outside of the military while you were in training?
The most common would be women's organization putting on dances, that kind of, which was absolutely excellent and had to be.
And you met your wife when you were overseas, right?
Oh, yes. That was a 100% effect of the war. I was away from my squadron visiting with a girl that I had met in Wolverhampton, and so it was a Sunday night, and I knew I had to get my get back to my squadron. And when I got to a place called Crewe, the trains were all stopped. The Germans had dropped a bomb there. And so all of the trains were stopped. It was a huge gathering point of trains and central railway. So I was just walking around. At that time, I was just walking from platform to platform. And I saw this bunch of girls, and I saw this one girl. And I continued watching her, and so I thought, you've maybe heard of Blackpool. It's a resort place in Great Britain, and these five girls were going to Blackpool for a one-week holiday. My squadron was not far from Blackpool, a little bit north of there. So I thought, hey, wouldn't that be great? I really was attracted to this woman, and wouldn't it be great if they were, they all clear sounded, and the conductors start blowing whistles and trains started to move, and I noticed these five girls were going towards my train, so I walked past this one and offered to carry her bag, and she let me, and I won't tell you the rest of it because I was a flight commander at that time, and I had a little bit of maneuver authority, and I made a date with her for next Friday night, and this is Sunday night, and I realized, hey, you dummy, you're smitten, so do something about it. So I got the aircraft in the air and took a flight myself. I forget what the hell it was, but and so at 6 o'clock Monday night, I was at Blackpool, and I found her and the girls, and they already had dates, and because that's what they were there for, looking for. But the girls knew that I had made a date with Hilda Friday, so they supported me, and so Hilda was allowed to break her date, and I had a date with her that night, and that's how it got started. Yeah.
Great story.
And it's been good, so, yeah.
How did people treat you while you were in training?
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you could be proud. Don't forget there's a war on. Yeah. And so you can't compare that to 19, to this year. Mm-hmm. No, there was a war on. And the Americans weren't in the war. So when I was in training, American tourists would be up here and giving you gum, and no, it was you were made feel pretty proud.
Mm-hmm. How did you treat others, like new recruits?
How did I treat others? What's
like new recruits when they were coming in?
Or, that bit. So that's a hell of a good question, because they were called Sproggs. You know, and there was a big deal made of somebody that had been in 6 months and somebody that was been in for 2 weeks. There was lots of fun and smart-ass remarks and teasing. Yeah.
What does Sproggs mean?
It's Sprague is some that's if you've only been in school for 2 weeks, you're a Sprague.
Okay.
That word isn't used very anymore.
I've never heard it. No. Interesting.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about the people you trained with? Where did they come from? Who were they?
Well, the wartime ones that I trained with were basically Canadian, completely. When in 51, it was completely different. They were from all over the world. But during the war, it was all Canadians. It was a good experience. They're a pretty damn good bunch of guys, no question about it. I don't remember any animosity, I don't remember any misery, but I guess maybe I was a little bit different. I had been raised under pretty harsh discipline, not harsh, but and so my life was easy, you know. I never got into trouble over breaking rules. I never had to carry a pack, go out on the parade square and walk all night, those kind of things, never once. So I'm not the right guy to ask that question, I guess. I had no problem with discipline, none whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Did you make friends with the people that were there, even though you were in competition with training?
With the other airmen? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Lifelong friends. Mm-hmm. My lifelong friend was Ray Burgess. We even ended up, he was flying Halifaxes out of central England, flying supplies to North Africa and Malta. We met soon after we joined up. We were so close that I did his eulogy at his funeral. He was a hell of a pilot, a hell of a guy. Mm-hmm. Hmm. I made lots of friends in the Air Force. The Royal Canadian Air Force would be one of the fine groups of military men, I would say, no question. You would have been proud to be any part of them.
You talked about how washout was a big motivation. Was there other motivations as well?
Well, there's the one he had in your heart, of course, was a huge motivation because, you know, there's another thing you have to put in perspective. There was no opportunity in 1940. The world was in doldrums in every way, shape, and form, and so here was an opportunity to learn to fly, of all things. And we were moving 15 miles from where I was born was an unemployed camp. A few thousand men couldn't find jobs. It was at Dundurn, Saskatchewan, this unemployed camp. And I suppose that could have happened 20 years sooner. It could have happened 50 years sooner, because the world has only moved into, we're in another kind of a little bit of a doldrum here now with unemployment rising and when you talk about 1940 or 42 or 4, you have to remember that the word opportunity comes up here. As terrible as it sounds, here's an opportunity to go flying and get killed, but here is also an opportunity to set yourself up for life.
So where did you go after you finished your training?
I came back to Hanley, Saskatchewan with my bride and went into business.
Mm-hmm.
Farm machinery sales.
Right back to the hometown?
Yes. Yeah.
And what about after you finished your training? You were already in the UK, right? So where did you go once you were finished your training part in the rest of the world?
Well, you'd move to an area where they had OTUs, operational training units, and AFUs, advanced flying units. That's exactly what happened to you, and then the Allies, Royal Canadian Air Force, and there was you could move I think one thing maybe that as no one has ever told you is that if you were brilliant, if your school marks were high, your chances of becoming a pilot were not great. They wanted you for navigators. I don't know whether that's ever been impressed on you or not, but it was a fact of life. I think you'd have to be one hell of a good student pilot to be allowed, if you had a very high IQ. And don't forget, they know something about your IQ now because you've been through ITS and you more than likely get massive marks. My brother but he, somehow or other, he slipped through the crack and he remained a pilot, even though his desk marks were very high.
Do you feel that your training adequately prepared you for aerial operations in the war?
I think I've got to say yes, because I have nothing to compare it to. When my brother was shot down, I don't think I remember thinking, God, I wish he could have shot that guy down. You don't think that kind of stuff. I know lots of young men that never came back, and it's sad, but I lost a nephew just a couple of weeks ago. Hilda and I were at a funeral in Hanley, Saskatchewan, of all places, my nephew. A smart young man with bloody cancer. So how does that death compare to the Chelm? We did not go overboard mentally or any other way when a friend was shot down or killed in a flying accident. I can't explain why. I think when the human body gets mixed up in a lifestyle like that, there's something called acceptance that must come up in here, and you just absolutely accept what's going on around you. Mm-hmm. I can't think of anything in Civvy Street, the life you are living today, I can't think of anything that would be like that. I think that war puts an image in your mind that leaves room for death. It's certainly different, there's no question. Mm-hmm. There's two very high-ranking officers were close to where, I just read this a couple of days ago, were close to where that Wellington was crashed. And it was an OTU Wellington, Operational Training Unit. And it crashed and stayed all in pretty well in one piece and burned to a frazzle. And this big shot and one of his lieutenants said, take me there, because it wasn't too far away. And it tells the story of what his mind, and this is a true story. He came there and the pilots, the bones and everything were hanging from the control column, and it was all open now because of the metal was, and so the wind was blowing through there, and these bones were shaking in the wind. And he took one look at it and said, "Let's go back to base." Something exactly like that would affect you. The very first death I saw, were at our station, I forget what station it was, doesn't matter, but a crew came that were going to go on their first operation tomorrow. They landed at our place because they knew a couple of people, and they going to have lunch, so they landed there and they were on a recognized flight training, and the comes time to go, and the station engineer will not sign their aircraft out because the starboard inner engine had mag drop, too big a mag drop, and he refused to sign it out. And so the engineer on the crew said, I signed it out to get here, and it worked fine, and I'll sign it out to leave here. They got into that aircraft, not a Lancaster, 5-6 letters, 4 engines, the other big aircraft.
Halifax? Or?
Halifax, yeah. They got in their Halifax, and I was there. I watched them, taxied over to the runway, took off, lifted off, and just after they lifted off, a shot of black smoke came out of the starboard inner engine. The pilot made a mistake, and instead of shoving power on, instead of pulling power off, he shoved power on, and the damn thing flipped over, and they were burned to death in a few seconds. That was a few weeks after I arrived in Great Britain. And we walked out there, and the fire crews were there, and they have great long wires with hooks on the end. They're pulling the bodies out. I saw it happening. It didn't do me any good, but it didn't do me as much harm as now as I would think. But that is an absolute true story. That's not long after I got to Great Britain. When you think of all of those aircraft that were coming and going, there had to be these things happen. The law of averages tells you it's going to happen. I don't know whether anybody ever tried to sort this out in their mind, but to me, it's inevitable. To me, it's inevitable that there's not going to be a crash out there on the highway. So, anyhow, that's a little bit of my feelings. Yeah.
So, what were the main differences between what you learned in training and what you did in real service?
Well, first off, I couldn't have been there without the training. I would not have been able to cope. Therefore, the training was, I think I got to say, excellent. Mm-hmm. When you realize that you take us away from the horses and plows and put us in the seat of a Lancaster in just over 2 years, it's got to be something pretty damn fantastic. But in the meantime, there's some heartbreaking things that are going to happen, because you're putting so much pressure on 100 human beings, it's not fair to expect that one of the 5 of those 100 aren't going to do something that wasn't called for, or their abilities weren't capable to cope, whatever. Mm-hmm. So, did I ever look down my nose at the training? Definitely not. Mm-hmm. I think we were in a wonderful Air Force, the Royal Canadian Air Force. Mm-hmm. And I've praised them many times in my life.
Just for clarification, what did you fly primarily in the war?
In the war? I suppose my main aircraft would be a Wellington. Okay. Quite a bit of time on Ansons. They're a fairly big twin. Mm-hmm. I was grabbed for training purposes far more than I expected to be. And then, of course, after the war, I was never dreamt that I was going to be called to go into training command. And I think that's because they liked the way I did it. And so every pilot was not called back. But I was called back, and when my wife saw the telegram, she said, let's go, because she was now in a little town, no sewer, no water, everything was by buckets, and so we went. But we did come back again after I finished my job.
That's the end of my formal questions, but did you have anything that you wanted to add to the interview?
I think you've done a pretty damn good job. Somehow or other you have a way of motivating a person, which is great. I would have done a way better job 5 years ago, because it's just in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years that my mind has started slipping. I'll think of lots of things after you're gone. Yeah.
There'll be more people to tell them to, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, yeah. When you the process that you're following, having a number of you, you're going to get it covered. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's some people like myself have written some fairly good books, and you see there's. These little stories that people write about flying, bombing, flying, fighter flying, between them all, I think they get an awful lot of it covered, mm-hmm. And strangely enough, I don't think you would. You're not old enough to have noticed this, but. Let's look at 1945-46. We came home. Many of us were married, just married, or just going to be married. And so the war was history, suddenly history, and no interest. We started Legion. I became the president of the Hanley branch of the Royal Canadian Legion. So now I'm going to get a 70-year pin in a few months for being a Legion member for 70 years. So where am I going with this? It stayed like that for a few years. And then about 7, 8, 9 years ago, a new interest came from someplace, and people were looking for books about the war. First one I read was, now I'm not going to be able to come up with a name, it doesn't matter. it makes me mad. Anyhow, I read it, and it was quite good. A guy from Winnipeg wrote the book. And 1,000 Shall Fall, that was the name of the book, 1,000 Shall Fall. And you can imagine who the 1,000 are. It's 1,000 pilots or air crew. And it just started, you know, when you're on Remembrance Day, started getting huge crowds, and today, last November the 11th, I pulled on my jacket and I went down. My walking wasn't very good, but somebody took a picture of me with my cane and actually the uniform that I was married in. And so something has happened, you see. The minds of people about the war has been rekindled, and they're rethinking, and it made it there's some things happen that I don't like. Did you see three or four guys on television, veterans, about a month ago, raising hell about the way veterans are treated? I was disgusted. I was absolutely disgusted that those bastards should get coverage, because we've been treated well. We have been treated very well. You see that thing there? That's veterans put that on there. I didn't ask for it, but they knew that I was getting up there, and all I have to do is press on that, in a minute or two, our phone will ring. It's people that are paying for this. I'm proud of our country. Sure, there's some errors made, no question. But I've never known a thing I've been involved in my life that didn't have some errors in it. There'll be errors in this, and there'll be. But the whole thing is that the concept is getting covered, and 100 years from now, that book will be read by somebody. I'll get you to mark something down.
Sure.
Don't tell me, Lewis, that you told another fib. You put that down, those words.
The words are, "Our Roots, University of Calgary, The Best 70 Years of My Life," by Lou Dudridge.
Yep, okay. You put that into your computer and then Google it.
For sure.
And the first book that I wrote will come up on your screen. What does this do? It's bound to prove to you mentally that I have been interested in the exposure that veterans are entitled to. Now that book, just flip it over.
Oh yeah. You flew the first private helicopter in Saskatchewan, it says.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Quite an adventurer.
Well, yeah. Somehow or other, people need to get up out of their easy chairs and write some stuff. You know, there's when you've accumulated 30 years of whatever you're going to do, it might be valuable to somebody. That book right there. In one day in this week, I had 3 phone calls from across Canada. It is in every Canadian library. I paid to put it in there. I paid for the book. I paid the $3 and something postage to get it to. It's in every single little little Saskatchewan library. Because I figure that it's almost a necessity that somebody do these kind of things. I'm not going to rot in that chair behind you, because that's not my way of doing things. I still go every Tuesday to the air crew meetings. I go once a month to the Vancouver Island Air Crew Association. I was president for 2 years. I believe in the word pride. I guess pride is a reason for me writing these books. I'm not ashamed of that. Why should I be? But there's the odd person that thinks, who the hell does he think he is? That doesn't mean a thing to me, because when I get phone calls, 4 of them in 1 week from all over Canada, that makes me feel bloody good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think if this turns out the way you hope it's going to turn out, someday you'll think, well, that was a good job I did there.
Hopefully.
Yeah, it will be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I told you already that I haven't got a grade 12, that my dad had to get me out of school at grade 10, because there wasn't even any food to feed us. I had to get out and find work. I never thought one bit less of my father over that. But then, of course, I wasn't aware of what losing 2 grade can do to you. But so, anyhow, that's a little bit about me.
Mm-hmm. Well, this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Flight Lieutenant Lewis Dudridge on March 14th, 2014. I want to thank you for sitting down with me. And I also have to ask you to sign this interview release form. And
yep.
We'll make sure that we get it signed here today.
Yep.
Here's a pen for you. And so, if you could just sign on that line there.
Okay.
Perfect. And then if you could just write your name on this top one up there.
Lewis Charles Dudridge?
Even just the first Lewis Dudridge. Lewis Dudridge would work fine. Yeah, thanks.
Not bad for 96, is
it? Not bad at all, yeah. So I would just like to confirm for the tape that we have both signed the interview release form. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'll sign it next. There we go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.